Perhaps you heard about the rodent who committed suicide when he found out that his dad was a rat. I would say that that analogy represents what's happening in our society today. What I am going to do is terribly offend some of you for the next 10 to 15 minutes. I will probably have everyone here mad at me, and you'll be ready to make a mass exodus before you've heard me out. I will lighten up the second 10 minutes or so, and then I will bring it down to a personal application of how you, in your world, can make a difference today. Over the past 12 months, we have heard so much about Pan Am Flight 103, and it's become synonymous in our thinking with disaster. It sends chills up and down our spines. To think of nearly 300 people that lost their lives totally unaware that they were in the very last moment of life, and the countless families and even nations that have been hurt by that disaster. And there has been a prolonged investigation that's involved a tremendous amount of human energy and time. And they tell us even millions of dollars in order to come to the basic understanding of, number one, who did it? Number two, why did they do it? Number three, how did they do it? And number four, where did they do it? In other words, what went wrong? How can we prevent a disaster of that magnitude resulting in that great of human carnage from ever happening again? Yet we live in a society where an even greater tragedy is happening than the breakup of an airplane, and that is the breakup or breakdown in our very eyes, in our generation, of a whole civilization of people. And I'm here to tell you this morning that we cannot rest any easier because we're seeing the dissolution of communism in the Eastern Bloc. We have our own problems. And history bears witness that a nation cannot survive once it's turned its back upon God. And the Word of God clearly tells us that a people cannot survive long once we have said, God, we do not need you. It is a built-in law that God built into His universe when He created this universe and when He created man that when we violate His laws, we in the end are the ones who get hurt. In fact, as someone has said, we never violate the laws of God. All we do is illustrate them. The American family has never been in worse shape than it is now. Statisticians tell us that in the 1980s, one out of every two children that are born will live and be raised by a single parent. And those children, when they come of age, are going to be filled with a hostility and an anger so that when we think that we have a problem with crime and suicide among our young people today, it's only going to be accelerated as this younger generation comes of age. And that's why it angers me, even in our own city, that we feel like the way to deal with the crime problem is to continually increase taxes. That's not the way to deal with a problem. It reminds me of a congressional interchange I heard about recently. And now, gentlemen, said the one senator as he droned on in his presentation, he says, let me tax your memories. And another colleague said, why gracious, why haven't we thought of that before? Let's just sort of tax people in order to deal with the problem without ever going back and saying, why are we where we are? What went wrong? Let's go back to the beginning, folks. Remember in 1985, we arrived in Athens with a group of people who were going to Israel right after, 2 weeks after, the hijacking of American Airlines. And they traced it back to a security problem in the Athens airport. When we arrived there, All of our luggage had to be put out on the tarmac. We were carted out there by big buses, and every piece of luggage that was not identified did not get on that plane because they assumed that the hijackers or the ones who hijacked that plane got on in a similar manner. In other words, you go back to the source. Our educational system is in shambles today by even the admission of our own Secretary of Health and Education and Welfare. He said recently that our whole educational system is in shambles. Never have we ever pumped more money into a system, and the end result has been so meager and reaped so little as we are doing in the area of education. But no one wants to go back in the beginning and say, what has happened? Why has it happened? Where did we go wrong? An amazing number, in fact, an incredible number of university and college graduates this past spring could not even read their own degrees. That's a tragedy, and we're going to be reaping the benefits of that for years to come. On top of that, we have all kinds of evils in our society. We have the problem of pornography, which has now become a big-time business, reaping billions of dollars a year for those who perpetrate this upon society and poison the minds of our adults and our young people and children alike. And the problem of drugs. We've been hearing so much about the drug war. And even this week, as we see unfolded, that one of our leading statesmen in Washington, D.C., a mayor of that great city, admits after all of these years to having a problem with drugs. Patrick Buchanan. By the way, I would tell you that on the west side of San Antonio, there are young people this morning in the 5 and 6 and 7 year old age groupings who are literally destroying their brains. They are frying their brains by breathing, inhaling paint. And it's becoming an epidemic. Patrick Buchanan, some time ago in an article in the Express News, wrote these words. He said, more than half a century ago, John Dewey set out to replace Christianity, which he considered outdated and inadequate for modern America, with a new humanist common faith using the nation's public school classrooms as its pulpits. The secularist takeover of the public schools is now complete, but the fruits of that victory, evident today, are surely not what Dewey and company had in mind. The godless children coming out of America's public schools are growing up to make a mess of American civilization. And many of these children raised in a secularized environment are actively searching for God to save them from the world of disbelief. Indeed, some of the best and brightest of our young people emerging from the moral wilderness of our secularized school, thirsting for transcendence and meaning in life, are even inventing new religions. And the newest of these is the New Age philosophy. Common to many of its adherents are a belief in reincarnation, in astrology, in the miraculous powers of quartz crystals, in trans-channelers, or mediums, individuals with the psychic power to summon up voices from centuries ago, mysticism for the masses. The New Age is upon us. Mario Donato wrote recently in the Chicago Tribune, just look around. There are now New Age churches. There are radio programs, stores, tapes, newsletters, magazines, seminars, and classes. Jewelry featuring quartz crystals and other healing stones is in the vogue, becoming ever more popular in this great land of America. Moody Monthly this past year, in an article entitled Evil in the Land, talks about how numerous young people, because of this void in their faith, nothing to believe in, are turning to Satanism in unprecedented numbers right here in our country. Satanic rituals are commonplace, and we have reason to believe they even happen right here in San Antonio. And an appalling number of these rituals not only involve animal sacrifice, but human sacrifice as well. One of Satanism's defectors is a girl named Sam Hoyer, who was raised, and I use that word cautiously, raised in New Hampshire in an orphanage in which there were 200 other youngsters. And it was an orphanage run by Satan worshipers. She was one of 200 children who were defenseless victims of rituals that routinely involved mutilation, sacrifice, sexual abuse, and even cannibalism. At the age of 5, this girl, having a twin sister, watched as her twin sister, 5 years of age, was ritually murdered there in front of her eyes. And I cannot describe to you what that girl saw. And on top of this, we have yet to see the full judgment and wrath of God on our land for the 25 million babies, unborn and counting, that we have sacrificed upon the altar of convenience because we don't want them, we don't have room for them, we don't need them, they're only going to be a hindrance to my future. But we're beginning to see the evil fruits of that. And then there's another force that we're reckoning with now, and that's the animal rights activists. They have some good things to say, but unfortunately, they are carrying this to the extreme. They stand for the rights of animals, but few of them are standing up for the rights of the unborn child. As Professor Alan Bloom, who is a secular educator, I quote him because he's not a Christian, he doesn't pretend to be a Christian, but he says some real Christian things. In a book that every one of you in the teaching profession should read called The Closing of the American Mind. And he says this relativism that has developed, this moral relativism, that there's no absolute truth. The end result has been that the American mind has not been opened, it has been closed. And that's what we're seeing. And here's what he says about these same people. He says, these same people who struggle to save the snail darter, bless the pill, worry about hunting deer, and defend abortion. We're all messed up. Now that I've offended nearly every one of you, probably, on this Right to Life Sunday, I want to go back to where we went wrong. In Genesis 1, Eric Arthur Blair, an English writer better known as George Orwell, perhaps that rings a bell, had a lot to say about the year 1984 and what it would bring in our country, in our world. And the news media did a blitz on his writings. But you never heard a thing said about another great statement that George Orwell made in 1945 in a book called The Observer. And here's what he said. When men stop worshiping God, they will start worshiping man with disastrous results. Always true. When men stop worshiping God, they will start worshiping men with disastrous results. And the Bible concurs with that statement. Francis Schaeffer, in what I believe was his last book, and he was one of the great thinkers of our age, in the great evangelical disaster in 1984, wrote these words. Listen carefully. Something has happened in the last 60 years in America, he says. The freedom that was once founded on a biblical consensus and a Christian ethos has now become autonomous freedom, cut loose from all constraints. Here we have the world spirit of our age, autonomous man setting himself up as God in defiance of the knowledge and the moral and spiritual truth which God has given. Here is the reason why we have a moral breakdown in every area of life. All morality becomes relative, law becomes arbitrary, and society moves rapidly towards disintegration. In personal and social life, compassion is swallowed up by self-interest. Me first. And then he said the end result is an elite, and authoritarianism as such will gradually form on society so that it will not go into chaos, and most people will accept that authoritarian structure. It's happened everywhere. It happened in Germany. It's bound to happen in America if present trends and present value systems are not reversed and changed. Now, in essence, our problems come from two things. Number one, an inadequate view of God. And number two, an inadequate view of man. In verse 26 of our text in Genesis 1, God says, "Let us make man in our image." The Hebrew word here you well know is bara, which means to create, to make new. God is doing a new thing. It's clear that when He creates here, that He's creating something far superior to any animal that He created in the previous 5 days. Man is far superior to anything that God did in the first 5 days of creation. He is doing something new. He is designing and fashioning something unique. And God called him man, because man is unique. He didn't just happen. He is of divine origin and by divine design. And it's amazing to me today how our educational systems can be in shambles because of the inroads of atheism, evolution, and humanism, and how popular they have become in every area of our society. But the end result is the man has no purpose, he has no value, he has no meaning in life, so therefore there's no reason to go on when life gets tough. Ralph Barton, who was one of the nation's top cartoonists, left this note pinned to his pillow before he took his life. He says, "I have had few difficulties, many friends, great successes. I have gone from wife to wife and from house to house, visited great countries of the world, but I am fed up. I am fed up with inventing devices to fill up 24 hours a day." So he ended it all, boredom. Ernest Hemingway, at the age of 61, when supposedly he was the greatest writer in the world, every person who had the desire to write idolized Ernest Hemingway at age 61. He said, "Life consists of one damn thing after another," and pulled out a gun and shot himself and blew his brains out, because there was no meaning, no reason to go on. Blaise Pascal, the great physicist and philosopher, and I wish we had more like him today, and thank God there are many, said this. He said, "There is a God-shaped vacuum in the heart of every man which only God can fill through His Son, Jesus Christ." Contrast that with the thought of a contemporary leading paleoanthropologist at Harvard, if you can say that word. The paleoanthropologists are those who are searching for the missing link or links between the ape and man. And for years they've been researching and digging up archaeologically in order to come up with what they believe to be will be the conclusive proof that man really did evolve from an ape. But they haven't been able to find the missing link or links. And so the end result is, this leading paleoanthropologist says, the assumption now is that those missing links do not exist. So he says, David Pilbeam is his name, "We no longer should say that we are descended from apes. We are apes." That's what a leading paleoanthropologist is saying. In other words, there is no missing link, so we must conclude that in the absence of missing link, that men and apes are actually one and the same species. I shared with you that illustration a week ago of that recent happening among the Moke people in Papua New Guinea. People out in the middle of nowhere that had absolutely no education, no training, no technology. When the missionary came and shared with them Jesus, and as he got into creation and said how there were people back in America who believed that man descended from ape, these people, all 310, groaned out and said, "That's stupid." Of course, they believed that man descended from two birds. But it is stupid. Listen to this one, a leading French biologist. Now, this is a leading biologist, Jacques Monod, put it this way. He said, "Man has to understand that he is a mere accident." And what these men are saying is that man must be brought down to the animal level. And the end result is what we're seeing in our society today. The results, the fruits of this kind of thinking are everywhere around us. But it flies in the face of biblical facts. To be made in the image of God implies a number of great truths. Number one, it means, being made in the image of God, that we have the capacity to do three things that none of the rest of God's creation can do. Number one, we have the capacity to think. We have intelligence. The rest of God's creation does not have intelligence. No matter how much you love your dog does not have the intelligence of a man. God reserved intelligence for man alone. You can sit here and you can listen to me and I can communicate to you the truths of God's Word because we've been made in the image of God. We have intelligence. And we can feel as God feels. We have emotion. We can hurt when people hurt. We hurt with those unborn babies that have been killed. 25 million over the last 15, 16 years, along with that 4,000 babies, over 4,000 babies that will be aborted in clinics around this country today. And we feel with those babies. Thank God He does have those babies, those tiny little babies in His hand. And we have the capacity to act as God acts. We can be holy men and women of God. We can willfully accept what God has done for us and the provision that He's made for us in the sacrifice of His Son and in the resurrection of His Son so that we now can do what God wants us to do. The rest of God's creation cannot do that. We have a will. And you will exercise your will when you leave here this morning. You will decide what you are going to do with what you have heard this morning. You have that capacity to be able to do that. Our golden retriever, Sasha, listens to Christian radio every morning. Connie has it on. She listens to James Dobson, Chuck Swindoll, all the biggies, you know, she hears them. And every now and then I'll come into where Sasha is as she's stretched out there on the floor and I'll say, Sasha, you've absolutely no excuse. You have heard the best of teaching today. You've had more Christian influence in your life than perhaps any other dog in the world. Some of you would debate that, I know. But you know, she just lays there, never responds. And I would tell you this morning, she's no further along in her Christian journey than Madeline Murray O'Hare's dog. Why is that? Because she doesn't have the capacity. God never gave it to her. A second great truth is in this passage in verse 27. God created them male and female, not male and male. He called them Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. And the problems of homosexuality and bestiality and all of these other things, these perversions of God's way stem from an inadequate view of God and man. It simply won't work. We can try to cover it up and hide it, or we can bring it out in the open. We can accept it. Whatever society does with it in the final analysis, I'll tell you right now, it will not work. As one writer put it, you can't do the wrong thing and have it turn out right. You can't do the right thing and have it, in the end, have it turn out wrong. God's moral universe will not allow that. Sin may have the intermediator work, but God's moral laws will always have the final work. The second implication comes from this great phrase, male and female, He made them. Only one man and only one woman per man. He didn't say He made them male and females. He made them male and female. One man, one woman. Society has paid a terrible price and always has for defying the laws of God in this area. I heard about a lady recently who wanted to marry four different men in her lifetime. She believed that each one would help her with the things that she needed most at that point in her life. So first she wanted to marry a banker, and secondly a movie star, and thirdly a preacher, and fourthly a mortician. When asked why, she said, one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready, and four to go. We laugh, but it's this easy come, easy go attitude towards marriage that is greatly contributing to the disintegration of our society. A third and final truth is stated in verse 28. I want you to hear me closely on this because we are so messed up in this area today. And I don't want you to misunderstand what I'm saying because I have the feeling that some of you will be prone to misunderstand me at this point. Notice in verse 28 of Genesis 1 that God commands Adam to do two things, to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And then He says, and subdue it, have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. God placed animals here to serve man, and not man to serve the animals. And when he says you are to subdue the earth and have dominion over it, in the Hebrew, these are military terms, meaning first, conquer, and secondly, rule. And as Dr. Henry Morris says in his concerning this, he says, this twofold commission to subdue and have dominion, to conquer and rule, embraces all productive human activities, science and technology, research and development, theory and application, study and practice are various ways of expressing these two concepts. These verses, along with the verses in Genesis chapter 9, are the answer to animal rights activists. And I say again, they're doing a good work in some areas. But I am concerned about a number of situations today. Let me remind you that we are not to arbitrarily misuse and abuse animals. In fact, the book of Proverbs says that a righteous man has regard for his animals. But on the other side of the coin, animals are put here for man's betterment, to serve man, to meet man's needs. I realize that some of you will want to take that further this morning and come up and debate me afterwards, but I'm just simply telling you what God's Word says. Now I want you to turn over to Genesis 9, and I'm going to answer the question I proposed earlier. Now it's after the flood, Genesis 9 and verse 3. In Genesis 1, only the vegetation, only the herbs of the field were to be eaten by man. But in Genesis 9, after the flood, there is a new edict. Verse 3, every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. That's all of animal life. Paul reconfirms that in the New Testament, 1 Timothy 4 and verse 4, where he says, every creature is good and nothing is to be refused if it is received with thanksgiving. For God created man for that very purpose, in order that he might be able to eat of all of these things if he gives thanks in the process. The problem today is we've stopped giving thanks. Now, the most probable explanation for why man was not to eat of the animals before the fall and why he was to eat of the animals after the fall is the Lord, after the fall, knew that man would always have a temptation to put himself on the same level as the animals. So God says, in order that you make this distinction, and this distinction be maintained, I am going to put this gulf between you and the animals, because I know you will always want to put yourself on an animal level. So he says, now you are to eat of every moving thing that lives. So that distinction between God, man being made in the image of God, and animals simply being created to serve man's benefit will always be maintained. Does that make sense? Made sense for one, anyhow. Let me make another statement in closing. Here we have the institution of human government in chapter 9 as well, through Noah. In verse 5, surely for your lifeblood I will demand a reckoning from the hand of every beast, I will require it. From the hand of man, from the hand of every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made him. Why did God institute capital punishment for the murder? Because he wanted to preserve the sanctity view of life, that man is made in the image of God. So therefore, when a man takes deliberately the life of another man, that man is to be put to death. And we have reversed the tables today, and we say that the unborn child has no rights, but we defend the rights of the murderer. Because we have an inadequate view of God, we have an inadequate view of man. I want to say two things in closing to you. My friend this morning, you do have worth. You may be here, and I want to speak directly to some of you. You may be here, and you may be at that point where you're considering ending your life. because you have believed this satanic lie that you are just here by accident. You have no purpose. There's no design. I want to tell you, you are of infinite worth. So much so, the Bible says, God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son. You can insert your name there. God so loved you, John. God so loved you, Mary. God so loved you, Bob. God so loved you, Jane, that He gave His only begotten Son. That whoever believes in Him will never perish. Never perish. But have everlasting life. You are of infinite worth. Jesus Christ is the one who gives that to us. And secondly, I realize a message of this nature can throw us into this sort of fatalism that whatever will be, and there's no sense in trying to change things because ultimately this is the way society's going, this is the way it'll end up, and I really cannot make a difference. I want to tell you this morning, you can make a difference. Chuck Colson, in his book Loving God, gives us an incredible illustration with which I close. He writes, one of the most important names on the world stage today is that of Alexander Solzhenitsyn. At one time, Solzhenitsyn was a prisoner in a Soviet labor camp. Like other prisoners, Solzhenitsyn worked in the fields, his days a pattern of backbreaking labor and slow starvation. One day, the hopelessness became too much to bear. He felt no purpose in fighting on. His life would make no ultimate difference, he believed. Laying his shovel down, he walked slowly to a crude worksite bench. He knew at any moment a guard would come along, order him up, and when he failed to respond, would bludgeon him to death on the spot, probably with his own shovel. He'd seen it happen many times before. As he sat waiting, his head was down, he felt a presence. Slowly, he lifted his eyes. Next to him sat an old man with a wrinkled, utterly expressionless face. Hunched over, the man drew a stick through the sand at Solzhenitsyn's feet, deliberately tracing out the sign of the cross. And as Solzhenitsyn stared at that rough outline, his entire perspective shifted. He knew he was merely one man against the all-powerful Soviet Empire, yet in that moment he also knew that the hope of all mankind was represented by that simple cross. And through its power, anything was possible. Solzhenitsyn slowly got up, he picked up his shovel, and he went back to work, not knowing that his writings on truth and freedom would one day inflame the whole world. Such is the power of the cross. Our God still reigns. And our God, if He chooses you, can use... If He chooses to, can use you to change the world. God plus one is a majority. In fact, God without that one is also a majority. What can we do? You need to speak up, my friend. I tell you, we have a lot of people in our congregation. We have media people represented in our congregation. We have numerous people in the political arena here in San Antonio. We have people who are numerous doctors and nurses and dentists and others in the medical profession. Your voice needs to be heard. You can no longer remain silent in these areas dealing with human life. I don't know what your profession is, but I know God can use you where you are. But I also tell you that without Jesus Christ, your voice has no power. Your life has no meaning. You will never make a difference because you, my friend, don't know the difference. And that's where some of you are this morning. You don't know the difference. You'll never be able to make a difference because you don't know the difference. You'll never know the difference until you allow Jesus Christ to come into your life and control you. He is the one who will make a difference in your life and make a difference in society through your life. But not until you relinquish control. I want us to bow our heads in prayer.